Rachel Grimm, and welcome to the podcast With All Your Mind. I'm here to help us understand the Bible with cultural and historical context, linguistic info, and other cool stuff. Enjoy. All right, guys, welcome back. This is Rachel, and this is With All Your Mind. And this is the last one in our little mini-series, our little baby season three. And this is the last one that's going to be about the Hebrew language. We've done, what was it, three other ones about Hebrew. And the next two are going to be about Greek influences with Greek, some Roman influences. So basically stuff with the New Testament. So you can more think of these last three plus this one as being about Old Testament characteristics and influences, and the next two will be about New Testament characteristics and influences. So I hope you're enjoying it. I really wish I could read more about this. I get reviews on new books and older books from the Society of Biblical Literature, and I read these little snippets about them, and I think, oh, that would be perfect. I should totally read that book. And I look it up, and a used paperback on Amazon is like $60. And yeah, no, I'm not paying $60 for one book that I want to read one chapter out of. So it's hard to get more information about some of these things, or at least all the information that what I want to get. But I hope you guys are enjoying. So today, our last topic for the Old Testament influences and characteristics is about Semitic expressions and Semitic ways of expressing emotions. Yeah, and remember, Semitic means the kind of culture, the kind of language group that Hebrew is in. So kind of Hebrew culture, and I'm just generalizing by saying Semitic. So yeah, ways of expressing emotion is what we're going to hit on first. And yeah, it's another topic that I had never really considered before, but I listened to a guy from Minnesota at this SBL conference that I went to in November, and he talked about Semitic expressions for emotion for half an hour, and now I'm here to pass on the wealth of information. The SBL conference was these sessions, maybe about 2 or 2.5 hours long, where they had maybe 4 or 5 presentations from different people, students and professors from all over the world. And this guy at SBL, first of all, I wish I had taken a picture of his suit because he was the classiest looking person at this conference. He had this, it was almost like a tuxedo with satin lapels. And I forget what pattern it had on it, but it was really interesting to look at. But his whole vibe reminded me of this British guy on social media, and I didn't look up his name. He's a comedian, I think. Ryan knew him, but I didn't. I think his name is Tony or Troy, but he's this guy. He has a social media account. I saw him on Instagram. He goes around in this like satiny smoking jacket, and he gives sophisticated compliments to people on the street. Have you seen this guy? It's either Tony or Troy. And he's British, but I love it because he just goes around complimenting people in these really elaborate ways, but a very like formal way. So I wrote down some of the ones that he said. I adored the way you laughed at that pigeon. Or you look pensive, but also capable enough to deal with anything that is worrying you. And he's saying this in a British accent, so it's even better. And then a guy wearing jeans and this kind of periwinkle colored shirt and then like a bright blue hat. He was like, you are an aquamarine blue jeans field of dreams. So anyway, the emotion guy at the conference was not British, but I've since learned, I looked him up, he was a professor, not a student, and he just got his PhD this past year, and his dissertation was on metaphors for happiness in the Bible. So he knows about emotions in the Bible. He talked about the metaphors in this session at the conference, what I was listening to. He talked about the metaphors that people in the Bible used for expressing emotion, and it never occurred to me before that they might have different metaphors. And it might be obvious to you, but we're going to go through some specifics. So different metaphors. And so I was thinking about this, like, do we do this? Do I do this? And yeah, I've never talked about fear following me around roaring like a lion. But why would I? Why would I? Do you do that? Do you talk about fear following you around like a roaring lion? It sounds melodramatic or too much, but why does it sound melodramatic or too much? You know, so it just got me thinking about all sorts of things. So let's look first. This is how I like to do it. Let's start out with the familiar and get to the less familiar. Let's look at a few examples of how emotions are expressed in modern English. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized we tend to be pretty simple and not focus on the emotions. We focus on the action that the emotion makes us want to take, or on the feeling that the emotion gives us, but not the specific emotion itself. We rarely name it. So we get interesting with what we want to do. I'm so mad I could chew her up, throw her out the window, break it, whatever the thing is. I am so upset I want to. I love him so much I could. We tend to, and you can tell me if you disagree, or maybe you do it differently, but we tend to express the intensity of our feelings with what our actions would be. But we rarely talk about the emotion itself or give analogies for the emotion itself. We do talk about what it feels like in our bodies. My face felt like it was on fire, maybe embarrassed or angry. But we don't really bring it back to the emotion. We don't name the emotion. So let's talk about ways that someone in the time of the Old Testament would express themselves. So these are Semitic ways of thinking, Semitic ways of expressing emotion. And if you remember, the Old Testament was written over a span of 1,000 years between about 1500 BC to about 400 BC. So it's a big span of time. There's a lot of cultural influences that went in and out of that time. So here's some examples. Hebrew speakers and modern English speakers can talk about emotions being in us as if we were a container. And this is a very simple one. The guy at the conference was talking about how this is a very Indo-European idea as well, more so than a Semitic way of expressing emotion, that very often Indo-European languages, and that's European languages, use the container metaphor. I am filled with is a good way to think about that one. Your body is a container, and you're carrying around all of this emotion in your body. So I am filled with rage. I am filled with happiness. I am overflowing with those kinds of things. That is the metaphor of container. You're the container and the emotion fills you up. Another analogy for emotion that we don't tend to use as modern English speakers is the emotion as an opponent or enemy. Like in Psalms 78:31, where it says that God's anger rose against them. Do you ever think of your emotion as having a life of its own, and your emotion kind of being like the enemy to the person that hurt you or made you angry? I don't think I have. I usually think of myself as being the enemy or the opponent, but not my emotion. I usually see me as being the actor, not the emotion. It made me realize that that might actually be a pretty good way of thinking of it, that your emotion is wanting to do something. Your emotion is the enemy that wants to attack somebody and not you. Seems like a good thing. And that way you can view your emotion a little more logically than if you are just the person trying to attack. How about this one? Emotions as physical objects or forces. Several times in the Psalms, it talks about shame covering like a piece of clothing. So I have one example here from Psalm 35:26. And this is in the NIV. May all who gloat over my distress be put to shame and confusion. May all who exalt themselves over me be clothed with shame and disgrace. So that's one that we don't usually use as an object or a piece of clothing or a force. I think I've heard people say that it, and we don't say what it is, but it felt like I had a weight on my chest. And we're usually talking about anxiety there. Or it feels like I have a heavy blanket on me. And we mean depressed, but we don't say that the depression felt like a heavy blanket on me. We don't often name the feeling that is doing that thing. So we don't say, my anxiety feels like a weight on my chest. And I realize that another difference that we have in modern English is that we make sure to use a simile. My anxiety feels like a weight on my chest. We don't say that my anxiety is a weight on my chest. We don't do that very much. It's like a weight. And maybe it's because of needing to use more logic when talking about our emotions. We don't want to seem silly thinking that our anxiety is actually a weight on us. So we do say a weight on our minds. I have a lot on my mind. I have a big weight on my shoulders. But again, we don't name the specific feeling with it. We don't name it as being worry or anxiety. We just say what's happening. So it might be why I have a hard time saying that I have anything in my heart. That's the container metaphor, right? Sometimes people will say I have joy in my heart or happiness or peace in my heart. I never say that. And this studying for this has helped me to realize that I, first of all, know it's not logical. That's not where I feel my emotion. And I realized that it's also not typical to say that unless you're a Christian, because it's Christianese to say that. It's adopting a Hebrew way of expressing emotion. It felt foreign to me, so I don't do it. Another one, this is about the language Akkadian, which is kind of like a cousin language or a grandparent language to Hebrew. They use an analogy of fear going into a body like disease. Now, we can relate to that one, I think. We say that something is eating away at us. We just never name, again, what's eating away at us. Fear, anxiety. But we say something's eating away at you. But I thought, you know, have you ever felt rotted out like an old pumpkin from fear? Like just something is gnawing away at you? Akkadian would do that for sure. I'm not sure about Hebrew. I didn't see anything about that. But it's like a disease or rot. The last one is that emotion can be imagined as a person. Isaiah says that gladness and joy will overtake people. And that's a, you know, that kind of analogy is used a lot in the Psalms as well. But overtaking, if you've ever thought about it, overtaking means catching up to someone or something. That's either an animal or a person. So Isaiah is saying that gladness and joy will run up behind somebody and attack them like an animal or a person. When you get specific about it, these metaphors are ones that we don't use, but they're familiar because we've seen them in the Bible, but we might not have thought through what exactly they're saying. So in general, talking about emotions is a bit different in Hebrew. There just seems to be a bigger variety of ways to do it that we don't do in English. And it's done in a way that describes the emotion and identifies it, not just expressing what the emotion makes you want to do. So I was thinking about this, like, does this mean anything about, you know, Hebrew writers or Hebrew speakers? Were they better able to identify their emotions? And then I was thinking, well, probably not. These are authors. These are people writing literature that have written down these analogies. Maybe that's why they're doing it, because they know how to put words to feelings. Either way, it gives us interesting ways to imagine the feelings of the authors. In the same way that each culture has a variety of ways to express themselves, we have a variety of ways to express ourselves in English, same thing in Hebrew. They also use different phrases and terms that another culture might not have, even in the same language. British English has specific terms and phrases and ways of expressing themselves that we do not do in American English. So sometimes expressions can give us hints about what culture someone is from, even if they speak multiple languages. So in the Bible, we have tons of these that come from Hebrew and tell us that we're dealing with the Hebrew language or somebody that speaks Hebrew in the New Testament. We'll talk about this. There are hints as to what languages people speak based on the phrases and the expressions and even kind of the linguistic patterns that they have in their speech, no matter what language it's in. So some of this might surprise you, but I think it'll make sense when I list it out. Number one, we have four different things for different expressions in Hebrew. Number one, this is super basic. The word saying, just that word saying, occurs 180 some times in the Old Testament, and it usually comes right after another word for say. Okay, so for example, and I don't have specific verses here, but you can look them up if you want to, like Jacob blessed his sons, saying, or God commanded them, saying, or the angels urged Lot, saying, Adam named his son Seth, saying. Okay, so it's redundant, it's repetitive. God commanded and said. Why did we have to have it two times? The angels urged Lot. We can urge is another way to say say. Why are we saying say every single time? This is a way to introduce a quote. It's quotation marks. It's Hebrew quotation marks. So because it was an oral society, they weren't necessarily making an exact direct quote, but the word saying is a way to introduce this is what that person said. Okay? So whenever you see the word saying in the Old Testament, you can think of it as quotation marks. They're quoting somebody. So a good example, Genesis 1:22, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let fowl multiply in the earth. So it's just trying to show you this is a quote. The second one is a pretty simple one, but I wanted to include it anyway. This is where Barzillai was helping to take care of King David when he wasn't living in Jerusalem. And this is what it says in the NIV for 2 Samuel 19:32. Now, Barzillai was very old, 80 years of age. He had provided for the king during his stay in Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. Now, in all of the modern translations, it says he was a very wealthy man. But if you look in the King James, it says he was a very great man. I didn't know that anytime it says great, that means rich. It doesn't mean powerful. But the two are often connected. But I think my brain always went to powerful first. And why was he powerful? Well, he probably had money too. But whenever you see the word great, Nineveh was a very great city. Does that mean rich? Or does that mean powerful? Or does it mean big? You have three options to think through now. But when it comes to people, it means rich. When it comes to places, it means big. The third one is Genesis 27. And this is just one example. There's lots of different examples of this. But this is when Rebecca is talking to Jacob. Isaac and Rebecca have Jacob and Esau. Rebecca is talking to Jacob about his birthright, his inheritance, and she's giving him advice on how to get his inheritance and how to trick Jacob into giving it to him, right? And what she says is, listen to my voice. Now, whenever you hear anybody in the Bible say, listen to my voice, what they mean is, obey me. So when Rebecca is telling her son Jacob to listen to her voice and do what she says, she's telling him to obey her and trick her own husband. Messed up lady. Come on. Listen to my voice literally means obey. Okay, last one, and I don't even know how to portray this one. Is it supposed to be funny? Is it? I don't know. I don't know. Ryan knew this one before me, and he had told me about it before, but I had totally forgotten about it. There's a Hebrew idiom that instead of saying man or male or son of a woman or anything else, just to mean male, the Bible has just this one idiom that says one who pees on a wall. Yeah, you heard me right. One who pees on a wall. That's used six times in the Bible. And the King James Bible eloquently puts it as one that pisseth against a wall. Like, oh, come on. Yeah, that's in your Bible. Surprise, surprise. So here's one example for it. And the context of this one made me think, is this like angry language? Because it sounds crude. So is this like crude angry language? I don't know. But here's one example. 1 Samuel 25:22. This is when David and his men are camped out and they have been watching over Nabal's sheep. And if you remember Nabal, Nabal means, I think, idiot or foolish. And this guy is fitting for his name. He is a foolish guy, but he's a very, very rich guy. He's another one of those great men. And David and his men are out in the fields and they've generally been taking care of Nabal's sheep. They've been protecting them against predators and against anybody who wants to steal his sheep. And when it was harvest time, David sent a message to Nabal saying, "Hey, we have been near your property and we've been looking out for you. And now that it's harvest time, we would like to join the party that you have at your harvest time." And Nabal says, "Get lost." And David is really upset. He's flaming mad. His face is on fire. And in the NIV, this is what it says. "May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him." So David is basically declaring war on Nabal and saying, "I'm going to kill every man on your property." The King James says, "So and more also do God unto the enemies of David." It's complicated. Yes, I know. "If I leave of all that pertain to him by the morning light, any that pisseth against the wall." So there's that lovely phrase. So that's just one for you to pull out when you want to impress somebody with your Bible knowledge or weird them out. Either way. So basically, what am I trying to say here? Is that there will always be unique phrases and sayings in different cultures and languages. And the phrases we use and the language we use gives people clues as to what we're used to, how we want to relate, and a lot of other things. It can give clues about our upbringing, our background, our education, our emotional well-being, and a lot of other things, including what we value and how we want people to see us. So there's really a lot in language that can help people understand us or confuse them. A lot of different things. We see that in the Bible too. The Bible is another piece of literature, holy, divine, inspired literature that has its own quirks and interesting things, such as pee against a wall. All right. I hope you guys have a great day. And I'll talk to you again the next time. Bye.